Hello, I'm Nick Spencer, and you're listening to the 9th series of Reading Our Times. In this series, we're navigating our way through a world of confusing and often contentious ideas, equipped only with big books, serious authors, and time to think. We're going to be talking about slavery and reparations, wokery and left-wing politics, poetry and our sense of the sacred. We're going to talk about the origins of the West, what's behind the assisted dying debate, about the way the Enlightenment has been co-opted into the culture wars, about how our evolutionary past continues to shape our political present, and in a live recording at the How the Light Gets In Festival in London, I'll be talking to critics and publishers about books and the future of civilization. And underneath it all, of course, lies the question to which Reading Our Times always gravitates. What does all this say about the human condition? At the age of 20, the British philosopher John Stuart Mill had what he called a mental health crisis. Mill had been brought up to be a highly educated, forward-looking reformer. But as he hit adulthood, he asked himself whether, were he to be successful in achieving his ambitions in life, would he still be satisfied and happy? When he realised the answer was a definite no, his life fell apart. It was put back together over the next few years in large part by poetry, in particular the poetry of William Wordsworth. What made Wordsworth's poems a medicine for my state of mind, he later wrote, was that they expressed not mere outward beauty, but states of feeling and of thought coloured by feeling under the excitement of beauty. In them, I seemed to draw from a source of inward joy. Mill is not the only reader in history who has reported such an impact from reading poetry. And Wordsworth is not the only poet who has had that impact on readers. For many people, many of whom, like Mill, would not call themselves religious or even spiritual, poetry is somehow able to enchant, to inspire, to heal, to give them a glimpse of connection, of transcendence that transforms their life. And indeed, particularly today in a secular age in the West, it is poetry, and indeed the arts more widely, that often boast the greatest ability to convey that sense of connection and transcendence that seems so important and so hardwired in humans. What's going on here? How does it work? And what does this ability of poetry to connect us say about human beings? The phrase I used a moment ago, a secular age, has become closely associated with the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor, whose 2007 book of that name was a major intellectual phenomenon and one of the books we discussed in the first series of Reading Our Times 4 years ago. Now in his 90s, Charles Taylor has written another monumental book. It's called Cosmic Connections, and it looks at, in the words of its subtitle, poetry in the age of disenchantment. Charles, welcome to Reading Our Times.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
There are a couple of really important ideas that underpin your overall argument in Cosmic Connections, and I think it's important that we cover these first before we get into the core idea of the book. The first relates to language, and it draws on an argument you made in an earlier book, The Language Animal, in which you draw out two different ways in which we humans use language. One of these you call denotive, and the other one is called constitutive. Can you tell us what you mean by denotive and constitutive language?
Well, yeah, think of them in the uses of language. I can just use language to communicate information and not even communicate in person, but communicate through writing. And that's what a lot of analytic philosophy theories of language have focused on, how it codes information. But language also makes possible certain kinds of relations, certain ways of being with each other. And that is missed by the merely denotative. And as a matter of fact, language is so connected to communion, to being together with others, that it's the, in a sense, the other way around. It's a very strong desire for communion on the part of the just born, which is the matrix in which language arises. The kid's just dying to be communicated with, noises made by the caregiver. And out of that emerges this more complex kind of language, which allows them to communicate information. You know, it hurts up here on the left side,
yes.
Not down there. Yeah. But so communion is prior to information.
Communion is prior to information. That's a really nice way of putting it. There's another really important concept that underlies the argument in the book, which is that of what you call spiral history. Tell us what you mean by spiral history.
Oh, well, spiral history is one of the theories of the German Romantics, that you start off with a certain relation to nature. The idea was that, you know, early human beings were very unsophisticated, just sort of lived in nature and didn't really reflect on it. Whereas, with the development of what we call intelligence, enlightenment, technology, we have another kind of relation to nature where it's over against us, we want to control it, it's the not us, we can't understand ourselves in terms of natural science, so there's a kind of gap. And the belief was that you return at the highest level when you really understand properly what it is to be human, to recover another kind of communion with nature, which is the one that actually I'm trying to look at in this book.
Yes.
Where, in other words, we produce a kind of sense of togetherness with nature. But that requires a very special kind of language, which is really artistic, but I'm focusing on poetry. And if I knew more, I could have written a book of this kind around painting, around music. But apart from occasional references, I focus on poetic language.
Well, that's helpful, because I was going to ask later on in our discussion about whether what you say about poetry also applies to other forms of creativity. But just going back to this idea of spiral history, I want just to clarify it slightly more, in that human origins at the beginning of this spiral history is one in which there's a divine plan, right? There's an integrity and a wholeness to the cosmos of which humans are naturally a part. And then that falls apart with the mechanistic revolution of the 17th century, and we lose sight of that, and it's only after that we begin to regain it, right?
Yeah, we begin to regain a philosophical vision of things, because we're now in the realm where we don't just feel these things, we have philosophical vision of them. We're now regaining a sense that we can recover this kind of communion with nature. But in between the most primitive times and the 18th century and the 19th century, there were all sorts of ways in which the felt connection to nature impinged in human culture, like the idea of the great chain of being and so on, right? It took the deconstruction of that by modern Newtonian science for, I would say, the hunger for some kind of connection to return with a possible solution, answer to that, which was the answer that art, and in this case poetry, provided.
Right? Mm.
So human societies have always had some kind of connection with the larger order until the rise of modern natural science and the Enlightenment, as it were, killed that or cast that in doubt or made us believe that that was just our own dreaming.
And at some point towards the end of the 18th century, which is really where your book begins, we try and recover that connection with nature. But we recover it in such a way that, as you say, recovering the language of insight isn't just adding to our dispassionate knowledge. It also reconnects us to the cosmos and realizes our essential purpose. There's an enhanced assertion of human creativity in this attempt to reconnect ourselves with the cosmos.
Yeah, because we do it, this is the strange thing, unlike earlier periods, someone like Wordsworth or Herndon is not making a scientific philosophical assertion about our connection. What they're doing is creating in the reader a very powerful experience of what it would be to be connected. But I talk about epistemic retreat because they no longer are saying, look, this is the way things really are independently of us. They're no longer making this kind of philosophical assertion. They're just saying, here is a really powerful experience of connection, which is answering some very powerful need or appetite or desire in your soul. I mean, that's the implicit point here, right?
Yes.
But they're not in the same universe or in the same game as Newton. They're not saying this is what it really is like outside of human life. They're saying, leave that aside for a minute and just live in this experience.
So is it fair to say that this underlying human desire for connection, that's always there, and before the Newtonian revolution, before the scientific revolution of the 17th century, there was a sense that humans could fully and entirely connect with it. But after that break, after that natural philosophical break, all we can do is, as it were, try and recreate it or sense it or feel it. We can't know it fully.
That's right. I mean, we can't know it from the outside, you know. My relation geographically to the nature around me here can be observed from any point of view. The plane passing over, the birds going by. It's an objective fact that here's me and here's the world around me. This is not like that. It can't be observed from outside. It is an experience that is lived from the inside or not at all. But it has this very powerful sense of this connection.
Now, many people naturally associate this particular moment in intellectual history with the Romantic poets, and you do talk about those, but actually your story really begins in Germany in the 1790s. What's happening then? Why is that moment so important?
Well, because it was a real set of questions about this and the beginnings of a kind of vocabulary to describe this new kind of relationship. In other words, you see with Hamann, the figure I talk about, he started off, you know, bouncing his ideas off the traditional pre-Enlightenment idea that the world around us is like the language of God, and he shifts that in a very interesting way. He says, no, it's not exactly the language of God. We translate this very important concept. We translate God's language into our language. Implicitly, it's very approximate. It's not exactly the way things are out there. So we have this shift where we're not saying this is what the world order is, but our language can translate that. And that's his way of understanding the point I'm trying to make, that we're creating the experience of, but we're not giving a point of viewless description of the world outside us.
So there's a genuinely deep and profound creative, participative aspect to the work of the poets, for example, then, because if they are translating the God's language, they are almost co-creators with God, right?
Yeah. But they're not co-creative of a fully self-standing world. They're co-creative of this connection, of this communion, see? And that's a big shift. In other words, there's a big sign of those were over their work. Newton, calm down. We're not rivaling you. We're not trying to say you're wrong and we're right.
What I find interesting about that, though, is that many people naturally recognise that this movement, at least in Britain, is a reaction against industrialisation. It's a reaction against the sense that they have been separated from nature. Germany is not industrialising in the 1790s. So what precipitates this transformation in Germany in what is still a very rural, very agricultural society?
Well, something else, but very connected. See, German idealism, let's say Kant, is all about justifying knowledge of the world. And so he gives a conception of our putting our own categories on the world. So already you're having a step in this philosophy to looking at the way we create the conditions of knowledge, right? Whereas the previous idea, there's a world out there and we find ways of describing it. So you have already this idea of the role we play. Now, this becomes a poetic issue because of something that is connected to but not the same as Newtonian science. It's the idea that we are free in relation to the world, right? And we are totally free to treat the world as we figure out it'll work for us. And this goes along with a very powerful notion of freedom we have in Kant. Now, what that gives you is a picture of a human subject that is radically free from the world, stands over against the world. And what they immediately feel is lacking here is any kind of communion with the world. Yeah? If you have an idea that the whole thing is our imposition of our concepts on the world, how can you have a sense that we are in communion with something outside us, which is, in a sense, feeding us, right? So via another philosophical route, you nevertheless have the same sense of hunger. So for Wordsworth and those people, you're quite right, the sense of lack arises from an attitude to the world which is one of control, right? So you get this whole business of improving landlords that are making over their beautiful estates in a way that will make more money. People like Jane Austen are implicitly objecting to that. So it's that kind of separation from nature which is hooking them into this whole project. In the German case, it's a kind of sense of total control from the outside which would put paid to any possible real sense of communion with. So it's the same kind of need, but worked out in a different way.
It's important to emphasize that there's been poetry about nature forever. It's worth just drawing this out because this isn't a radical discovery that nature exists. You mentioned poems in English from the early 18th century, such as John Denham's Cooper's Hill or Alexander Pope's Windsor Forest, that are focusing on the natural world. But what happens 100 or so years later is radically different. I wrote down a few of the lines from William Wordsworth's Tintern Abbey because they're so often quoted here, spectacularly beautiful, but they also, I think, seems to me epitomise what you're talking about. He writes at one point, "And I have felt a presence that disturbs me with the joy of elevated thoughts, a sense sublime of something far more deeply interfused, whose dwelling is the light of setting suns, and the round ocean and the living air, and the blue sky, and in the mind of man, a motion and a spirit that impels all thinking things, all objects of all thought, and rolls through all things." There's something radically different going on there, isn't there? There's something very different from the kind of nature poetry that was being written 100 or so years earlier.
Yeah, because that nature poetry relied on the senses of order out there in the universe. So there was no kind of hiatus between some scientist or even philosopher in this case describing the world and the experience of communion with the world. These didn't in any way contradict each other. But when you get to the age of Wordsworth, on the contrary, you get the sense of we're being separated from. So what he's doing is recovering a way of sensing very powerfully this union with nature. So he feels coming at him from that outlook over the Wye Valley and the old abbey, a sense of a force running through all things, linking him to, connecting him to this nature. So we completely bypassed theory. There's no kind of, at that point, respectable scientific theory which can be the sort of perfect objective correlative of this experience, which you have with you know, Cooper and all those 18th century thinkers.
And in Wordsworth, the presence of the poet himself is very important, isn't it? It's not as if he is trying to objectively describe that reality that's out there. His presence within the landscape, his sense of connection within the landscape is absolutely central to realizing what it is.
Exactly, yeah. It's a statement of connection rather than a description of something out there that could exist. When I leave the scene, it could exist just as easily as when I'm in the scene. No, this is something which requires me to be in the scene and feel this connection, which I'm recovering for you, for the reader.
So this connection is a familiar one and a much desired one when it comes to travelling through the Y landscape as Wordsworth was. But it's interesting that the two longest chapters in the book are dedicated to Baudelaire and Stéphane Mallarmé, who are not romantic poets in the way that Novalis or Wordsworth or Keats are, and who very much write more about urban landscapes. So this isn't just a matter of connecting with the wider natural world, is it? There's something that goes way beyond just nature.
Yeah, because in a way, the center of gravity of this whole push goes from the attempt to recreate a sense of a continuing order. The sense that we aren't in a continuing order, that we're in a cosmos which is in constant change, which goes way, way back in time, right? That begins to eat away at any attempt at communion with what's supposedly continuing order. So with Baudelaire and Mallarmé, you don't have that anymore. What you do have is a real struggle. Baudelaire is the best example of this. A real struggle with lived time. Note that already we're in a world in which lived time and cosmic time are separated in people's minds. You know, when Augustine, you know, gives his famous theories about time and so on, the two aren't separated. But now that we have a sense of the world out there as utterly rebarbative to any kind of sense of communion, right? That the issue becomes centered on the issue of lived time. And the thing that Baudelaire hates and fears more than anything else is what he calls spleen, which is his word for a kind of melancholy, right? Where you have a sense of what time is just a repetition of meaningless change, one element after the other. And Baudelaire's answer to this terrible craving is actually to produce poetry about meaningless time, which raises it to a level of joy. Because as one describes it, one recreates a sense of meaning in these connections, right? It's really very musical. It's taken up in the music of the poetry. And that is, it's a radical shift.
You use a number of phrases to try and capture this in the book. You talk about higher time or gathered time or moments of intensity or duration without succession. As I understand it, these are all an attempt to describe, again, that experience, that feeling in which humans are connected in a kind of a truly profound way with what you call cosmic time, right? In the same way as Wordsworth's Tintern Abbey is an expression of our connection with the natural world, Baudelaire connects us or tries to show the connection we can have with eternity. Is that a fair word?
For him, no, but for Post, for instance, you know, maybe that's the right word. I mean, but it certainly is, in all these cases, connections across time that are just totally different from what we ordinarily understand as one moment after another, from what our descriptions offer us, from what a lot of our ordinary experience contains. There's one damn thing after another, and there's no meaningful connection. They recreate a sense of profound connection across times that don't touch each other.
I want to explore a little bit about what actually is going on here and why is it that poetry can work like this? How is it that it is able to connect us in this way? You talk at one point in the book about how there are three elements to the way that poetry works. There's the music of the speech, as sound, rhythm, meter, rhyme, that kind of thing. There's the music of the thoughts and the images, the associations that the verse has, and then the assertions, the points that are made in poetry. What is it you think that enables poetry to connect us in this profound way, both in time and space, that it seems to touch something so profound and perennial in the human soul?
Well, that's something very mysterious. I wish I could answer that question. But certain, if you look at Post, I mean, somebody might object, this is not really poetry, this is prose, but that's not the relevant point. The point is that this is language which makes us live in a time where we're connected in an extraordinary way. We bring together, you know, the moment we originally had the Madeleine and the moment we're experiencing it in memory, they come together in a kind of, well, I have to use the word higher time. They're somehow connected, even though we know that they're very far apart in actual measured time in the ordinary sense. So we create an experience of connection across time, very powerful experience. It's crucial that we have the same kind of feeling of something really higher experience, analogous to the one that Wordsworth gives you of the Wye Valley. You know you're living a moment, a higher moment, a moment when you're grasping some higher reality, which is very moving. And that's the analogy between these different kinds of case, even though there's these massive differences between Wordsworth and Baudelaire, because we're not connecting to a continuing order anymore, and we're connecting across time rather than across space, if you like. So there's something very different, but my hypothesis here is it's answering some deep need, which is perennial in human beings, which can only be met in very different ways because of the utterly different situations in which they find themselves.
I want to pick up on a couple of phrases you use just then. One of these is this deep need within humans, and the other was the phrase grasping higher reality. Both of those assume or point towards the fact that there is a reality there. There is a, however we might want to describe it, a dimension or an aspect to reality that is implanted, or desire for connection with is implanted within the soul. And this is one of the ways that humans throughout history have enabled that connection. There will be some people listening to this and saying, actually, it's illusory. This is just a sort of a subjective desire that human beings have, but it's not actually indicative of anything that's real. It's just feelings, really. There's no deeper or higher reality that there is for us to grasp there. How do you respond to that?
Well, I respond to that by saying I couldn't convince those people. I couldn't communicate across the gap. Why? Well, because they have already, at some level, decided that everything that is real is available to, trackable by modern natural sciences. And there's absolutely nothing you can point to through the lens of modern natural science which backs this up. Science can also be broader, but in the sense of natural science, they just see a lot of people wandering around the same environment, and some come back with reports of strange connections, and others come back with reports that can be scientifically verified. So there's just nothing that can be done here to convince those people. And that is quite a problem. I mean, the problem that it poses to us who don't take that stance is a problem of discovering and exploring languages which bring out this deeper experience. And it's very, very interesting. I mean, imagine yourself in conversation with somebody who's very scientifically minded, and you have this kind of response to this poetry, and he said, I think you're crazy, I don't see what's going on. And you find yourself struggling for languages. It's very interesting that some of our deepest moral and ethical experiences, we find languages for them in music, for instance. Something resonates with that music. But there's no way I can think of that you can cross the gap. That is, there's no absolutely crucial knockdown argument I can give this person, which has to say, oh yeah, I have to, I haven't taken account of that. That's very important. So in a sense, it's a standoff, because they're saying, you can't prove this scientifically, so why should I take it seriously? And I'm saying, there's more in heaven and earth ratio than it's dreamed of in your philosophy, right? And is there or isn't there? I don't see how to break this logjam. What decisive argument to put in here. The only argument is to expose them to poetry, music, etc., which really tries to hint there's more. But if they don't take that,
It seems to me that so much of this is predicated on the presuppositions or the framing or the worldview that people bring into these conversations, yeah. And that in the light of that, the conversations themselves are unlikely to change people's views. What might do is the experience itself. I began in my introduction talking about John Stuart Mill's mental breakdown at the age of 20 and how it was the experience of Wordsworth's poetry that helped transform him. I think for so many people, it is the experience that does that.
Yeah. I think virtually for everybody who will respond to the book in that way, it's some kind of experience that they've had, which makes that difference. But I mean, you've added an extra feature to this, that Mill had this terrible period before he read Wordsworth, in which he looked at the world as his father and Bentham had described it and felt, oh, that's so meaningless, right? And it got to him. What is reflected in his future philosophy is that, okay, I'm still utilitarian, it's all pleasure, but there are higher pleasures and lower pleasures, right?
Yes.
Which a strict Benthamite would say, it's more garbage for philosophical nonsense.
It's almost as if, to pick up a phrase with which you will be, of course, very familiar, these are quasi-spiritual experiences for people who live in a secular age, right?
Yeah, right. And that's something very analogous. What I tried to describe in a secular age was the kinds of experience of people I'm calling seekers that are looking for some kind of spiritual path, right? So there again, what are they doing? They're getting intimations of immortality. They're getting intimations that they're trying to articulate, right? And they're following that kind of path. But if you don't share any of those intimations, it all sounds like, you know, so much raving or so much totally subjective verbiage.
I want to just explore a little bit about how what we've been talking about does or doesn't perhaps map onto a more familiar religious worldview, and in particular Christian worldview. I was very struck by the range of figures that you tackled in the book and their relationship with what you might call orthodox Christian faith. And just going through a few of them, Wordsworth became more orthodox as he got older, but he was attacked earlier in his career for effectively being pantheistic. Keats and Shelley, whom you mentioned, were not in the least bit Christian, really, Shelley in particular, but Hopkins, of course, was.
And
Eliot became a Christian, and Baudelaire wasn't. So there doesn't seem to be a great deal of pattern in the various poets that you're dealing with in terms of their understanding and their relationship with the Christian faith. How do you think what we've been talking about, this, for want of a better phrase, this spiritual experience through poetry maps onto orthodox Christianity?
Well, I mean, it doesn't in its totality at all. As you say, some people have a sense of connection which involves negating orthodox Christianity. So welcome to the contemporary world where what we have is this immense spread of very, very different options. We have anti-spiritual options, we have anti-aesthetic options, and then we have a wide range of people moving across the boundary of the aesthetic to the spiritual, to the, we could even say in a more narrow sense, religious, which are all coexisting with each other, and in some cases feeding off the same works of poetry or music and so on. And it's really, it's a very complex, very confusing scene. So what we have to add to that, which I think is very interesting, is that there is a kind of new ecumenicism among religious people and spiritual people in general, very different from the kind of religious world of the up till the early 19th century, where, you know, if you were Catholic, the Protestants were wrong, if you were Protestant, the Catholic, and stuff, and Muslims are obviously wrong, and so on, to a world in which people can explore and are even inspired in a way by differences, or rather by meeting some sister soul, some sympathetic spiritual movement in Buddhism or in Islam, or if you're Christian, so on. And you have very important theologians today like Thomas Halleck, who are even saying that's something that should be an essential part of our Christian faith. that we're always failing to recognize that we're leaving something out, that we aren't facing certain deep issues. And this meeting with difference reminds us and forces us to do that. So here we're entering into some feature, very important feature, I think, of the contemporary world, that we're, in a certain sense, thrown together with people with very different outlooks, very different spiritualities. And there are very narrow ways of meeting that. I mean, there are extremely narrow Christians and think that Muslims are totally wrong and vice versa. And there are extremely narrow scientifically minded people who think that these all these experiences and art are just, you know, so much moonshine. And then there are people that are open to these differences and live a different kind of life. And I think live their lives, whatever they are, with atheist or Christian or Muslim, in a very different way.
Yes.
Than the ones who are utterly dismissive of difference.
So would it be fair to say that some of the phrase you use, epistemic retreat, that we see in this poetry, some of the perhaps epistemic humility that's involved in this, is actually very helpful to the modern religious mind, which has historically very often not been very epistemically humble at all, but has been unduly confident that it knows the entire truth. We benefit really from this sense of epistemic humility.
It's a wake-up call to what we're not seeing, what we're repressing, what we're just setting aside. And that also means people that we're devaluing and saying, you know, they don't have anything to teach us there. Let's get rid of them altogether. It's a quite different attitude, which I think is much more in keeping with Christianity and Islam properly understood than the one of the very enclosed people who just know it all, right? Know exactly what it involves.
Mm. The poets you discuss in the book range over the last 200 years or so, and the most modern is Milosz, a Polish poet who died, I think, only 10, 15 years ago. Who would you say, in your mind today, best captures what you've been talking about? Is there anyone writing, or indeed perhaps composing today, that you find is especially successful, that might be the wrong word, fruitful in enabling people this cosmic connection?
That's a very good question. I don't know if I can really answer that. I'd have to think further. I'm really stumped for good examples.
I don't know if you're familiar with the music of the Estonian composer Arvo Pärt.
Wonderful. That's a wonderful example, yes.
Which I find absolutely transformative. And we've been talking about poetry, but as you said right at the beginning, much of, perhaps all of what we've said is in principle applicable to music, perhaps even more so.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I've been utterly inspired with Arvo Pärt. I've actually met him and I'm very impressed.
I'm envious.
Yeah.
The overarching theme of Reading Our Times interviews is about the human condition, the human soul. And in particular, the question I like to leave people with is, what does what we've been talking about tell us about the human condition? What would be your answer to that, Charles?
Well, one very important thing, we're just beginning to discover things about the human condition that have just come onto our horizon and which weren't in any way dreamt of. So, you know, keep tuned to the station, I mean, the station, our history as it advances, and you will be constantly surprised, knocked off your certain stance where you have everything nailed down. But that's the road to follow.
The book is called Cosmic Connections, Poetry in the Age of Disenchantment. Charles Taylor, thank you very much indeed for speaking to Reading Our Times again.
Thank you very much, Nick.
Next week, I'll be speaking to Elora Finlay and Julian Hughes about the reality of assisted dying.
But I think it's worth pointing out that even if you look at Oregon's figures, the reason that people have cited for going for assisted suicide are primarily existential and social reasons. So fear of being a burden is in over half of the people, and much higher than pain.
You've been listening to Reading Our Times from the think tank Theos. It's produced by Phil Bodger. Our team includes Daniel Turner, Lizzie Harvey, and Ginny McDonald. Special thanks to Nina Humphreys, who composed our theme tune and all the music. You can subscribe to Reading Our Times on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And you can also find us on our website, theosthinktank.co.uk. Don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes. It'll help other people find the podcast.